spoke to me, telling me he was now on a happy level of the fourth subplane, and would look after JP. He asked me to explain something that puzzled him. His memory, he thought, must be getting confused, 57. Because he began to have vague thoughts about Rome, as though he was somebody else besides himself. I explained, of course, that he was probably getting some clairvoyant recollections of a former life, and he quite appreciated the idea. I asked about his present surroundings. They were very pleasant. He seemed to be living in a house that was just exactly the kind of house he used to picture in imagination as the ideal house he would like to have. Of course, this was a pleasant kind of thought form he had unconsciously created. He also said he was beginning to have a curious sort of feeling, as though he were getting lighter. It was quite a pleasant feeling, and he thought he had been told that it betokened some impending change that would involve his translation to some superior condition. His house was a country house with gardens and flowers, grass and trees, though they did not seem to want any attending to. He spent a great deal of time in the garden, thinking pleasantly of bygone times, and visited by people he had known, his father and mother amongst them. The time just glided by. There was no night, no sense of being tired. He had no wants. He wound up by again promising to look after J.P., who, I was glad to think, having, 58, played the game and cultivated a sense of honor, would now be set free from the boredom he had been so long enduring, and would find any level of the fourth subplane far more agreeable a region to inhabit than even Pall Mall. 59, Bill Smith, I had been wishing to get an authentic account of the passing to the next state of existence of someone representing the humbler classes. This wish was met by one of my loftier friends, who contrived to bring along an ex-costermonger, one whose account of himself was intensely amusing as well as instructive in its way. And it confirms a brief experience I had a good many years ago, when a highly gifted psychic of my acquaintance endeavored, for my information, to get a glimpse of life on a low level of the astral plane, and, so to speak, ran up against an ex-coal-eaver, who was found still hanging about the poor dwelling in which he had lived, with the vague idea that he was still smoking his pipe there. He must have been a harmless creature, as he did not seem to be suffering in any way, simply passing a sleepy, idle existence for many years, after which no doubt he would have been helped up to the 60 lower levels of the fourth, and eventually to some rather colorless variety of the devachanic state, in preparation for a new birth. My new acquaintance spoke with the same sort of phraseology that he was used to in life of the physical order. I wish I could give every word of his own as he told his story, but my notes do not enable me to do this completely. I shall endeavor to do so as nearly as I can. He gave me his name as Bill Smith. He had been a costermonger with a donkey cart somewhere down Commercial Roadway. Small profits, you know, and quick returns. At about 30 he married, to make an honest woman of the girl. They led a respectable sort of life in a couple of rooms and had 10 kids. I was a hard-working sort of chap, but fond of beer. I did not mess up things badly. Then he died of some fever that was prevalent in the Commercial Road at the time, and hardly seems now able to identify the actual period of his translation to another plane of life. He only knows that he had a rotten time. He seemed more or less in the dark, but he could hear people talking. He had a great thirst upon him. It is impossible to make out how long this condition lasted, but eventually he was addressed by some chap, 61, who called him by name. "Yes, Bill Smith, that's me." His new acquaintance told him that he would be happier if he left off wanting beer. "Can't do it, Governor." "I'll help you," he said. "You want to get clear of that thirst, don't you? All right, Governor. Then come along with me." Then he took Bill to some place where, "Shelp me, Bob," there were a lot of people sitting round a table singing hymns. Then they began praying. That wasn't much in my line, but there were a lot of people there like myself. There was one old chap at the table with white whiskers. He seemed a bit of all right. Someone told me to go up and stand behind him, and when I did that I felt just as if I was sucked down a drain hole. Then I found I was talking through the old man and asking for beer. Then an old woman began talking to me like a Dutch clock. She did read me a lecture. She said, "We'll pray for you. will help you to get rid of that desire for drink. You say after me, I don't want any drink. I said it to oblige her, and somehow I began to feel better. Then she made me say it three times over, and shelp me Bob, I didn't feel any more desire for the beer. Then I saw the man that brought me, and he said, come along. And we floated away right, 62, over Canning Town, where I used to live, till we came to a nice little house like a country cottage with a garden. You stop here, he said, but I said, I can't afford to live in a place like this. I must finish the story in other words than those Bill employed, as my notes do not enable me to recover them exactly. He was soon enabled to realize the situation, saw his old father and mother, who came to visit him, themselves apparently a little further on, and later, one of his sons came, a boy who, at about the age of 14, had been killed in a motor car accident, and in advance of his father had reached a somewhat higher level. One thought in connection with this little story which the reader should not let slip, has to do with the humble spiritual séance held in the far eastern region of London by the good people exerting themselves for the benefit of the poor spirits who were attracted to their circle. In the realms of poverty it would seem that in more ways than one, on more planes than one, the poor are the most sympathetic and helpful friends of the poor. 63. M.S. Wonderful narrative. I must now go on to deal with a story replete with the utmost pathos, whether we pay attention to its physical plane beginnings or its astral conclusion. It is profoundly instructive, in my estimation, in more ways than one, for it is a life of utter degradation as regards its physical prelude, and of beautiful exaltation in the long run. It was a female life on earth, and I will call my poor heroine M. M. She was born the daughter of lower middle class people in a country town, small shopkeepers, narrow-minded, devout Methodists. As a young girl she began to be troubled with intense sexual desire. The conventions of modern literature prevent me from going into minute detail concerning the way these feelings worked, but it is easy to understand how, under the circumstances, she became at a very early age the prey, the eager prey, so to, 64, speak, of a young man in her own class. And the natural consequences followed. When her condition was discovered by her parents, the father actually and literally kicked her out of the house at night, telling her to go to the devil, her master. The behavior of this horrible wretch is a wonderful illustration of the brutality that can coexist with the stupid bigotry of a religious fanatic. That man's crime in so treating his unhappy daughter was responsible, by all commonplace reasoning, for the degradation she ultimately sank into. Nor indeed do the mysteries of karma, in this case, which inevitably condemned the poor girl to a life of suffering, relieve the father in the smallest degree from the guilt of his cruelty, but we may look into that matter later on. The hapless outcast, after vainly battering for a time at the door in the hope of gaining readmittance, wandered vaguely on and sank down at last exhausted on a doorstep. There a policeman spoke to her, and took pity on her, took her to his own little home, where his wife gave her shelter, and next morning sent her off by train to London. She had no money to speak of. After paying her railway fare she had 3 shillings left. Turned out onto the bleak hospitalities, 65, of King's Cross, she wandered on at random up the Pentonville Road apparently, and came to some place where there were market stalls in the street. Leaning up tired against one of these, the rough man in charge asked her what was the matter, and she told her pitiful tale. Here again we have an example of the touching way in which the poor help the poor. The man took her home to his wife, who actually befriended her to the extent of keeping her with them over her confinement. One can imagine how that good costermonger, doubtless fond of his beer, like Bill Smith, and free with his language, would have been scorned by M.S. Methodist father, only worthy himself to lie in the mud under the other man's barrow. M.S. child died, fortunately enough. She did what she could when she recovered to help the woman with her work, and tried to lead a straight life, but found no opening for earning money. Then she fell in with some man who took her to a music hall and afterwards to some place to have supper. She must have been drugged in some way, for she remembers no more than that she found herself on coming round in a strange house, in bed. Needless to explain the kind of house it was, 66, M. had been enlisted in the great army of white slavery. She was pretty, and still of course ridiculously young, about 16 or 17, I make out, a valuable recruit for her captors. She was nicely dressed and sent out into the streets. After a while she had the good fortune, so to speak, of attracting the fancy of a gentleman she met, who took charge of her and gave her a little establishment of her own somewhere in St. John's Wood. This interlude seems to have been the happiest period of her brief and troubled life on the physical plane. But it came to an end, as such arrangements always do. Her protector had to go abroad. He gave her £100 at parting, and with this little capital behind her she made desperate efforts to get some sort of honest work by which she could live. But all in vain. She had no references to give, no character, and so eventually in despair she plunged back again into the mad vortex of fast life. By degrees she took to drink, found herself tainted with the hidden plague, was in hospital for a time. Then one night in Piccadilly she was spoken to by a lady, who asked her to come to a missionary meeting. She was not particularly eager, but went in a 67, spirit of curiosity. There she had a curious experience. A clergyman was speaking, and she saw a light round him and at the back of him a face looking at her with pitying tenderness. She believed it to be the face of Jesus, and she felt stabbed to the heart, but rushed away to her own room and took refuge in whiskey. Recovering in the morning from her drunken sleep, she felt her heart broken. That night, after wandering about, she found herself at the corner of Wellington Street and the Strand. An ungovernable impulse came over her to end it all. She went on to the middle of Waterloo Bridge and flung herself over. She remembers well the bitter cold of the water, the suffocation of drowning, and the vain longing to be back again, even in the misery from which she had tried to escape. Then began an extraordinary and terrible experience. She had passed through the change called death, but found herself back again on the bridge. Again she went through the wild desperation of her suicide, repeated all its experiences. Again threw herself into the river, again went through the sensation of drowning, sank into brief unconsciousness and then repeated the whole ghastly cycle of suffering. 68. So it went on for what seemed an eternity. I am told the process went on for at least a year, she thought for 5 years. The idea is too horrible. Such a record challenges one's faith in natural justice. There was nothing in M.'s dismal life to claim any penalty remotely resembling this awful period of expiation. From the first she was infinitely more sinned against than sinning, the victim in the first instance of hideous cruelty. The outcome of a bigoted superstition scarcely less loathsome, than the helpless prey of a social system almost equally stupid and pitiless. From the ordinary human point of view, what she needed was tender care and consolation on the other side of the great change. Seeking some intelligible explanation of the actual course of events, what I am told is this. The awful suffering of the period described was not the outcome of the life just spent. It was the accumulated karma of several lives of degradation and infamy. 4,000 years ago, M. then in a male body, had been a student of occultism on the threshold of the path. Like many other students of that period, he strayed from the path, in this case with exceptionally disastrous results. He gave way to sexual passion regardless of all considerations, 69, beyond the desires of the moment, and in his next life, in Greece, passed over into the female sex and again became absorbed in similar excess. The story was repeated in a later Roman life, and then, the higher self getting desperate, deliberately chose the M. life for the next incarnation, in order by extreme suffering and misery to expiate and at the same time extinguish the tendencies of the past. The expiation was terrible, but must not be thought of as the consequence of the one life immediately preceding it. Nor, except for the intense sympathy one cannot but feel for the sufferer, is it to be thought of except as an awfully inevitable prelude to the beautiful results that followed. For there came a time when she heard a voice saying, "Poor soul, The time of release has arrived. Then she was borne away, and went through some fresh experiences of a trying order, though insignificant compared with those she had been so long enduring. She was still for a time in Melan's domain, and was put into touch with scenes of human debauchery, but all passionate desire had been burned out of her nature. She was alone for a while in some desert region, but a time came at last when the great lord or that region told her, "You are 70, free, farewell." Then she was borne away, and found herself in a beautiful country cottage where she had a sense of being at rest and at peace. In the distance she saw what seemed to be a mountain, and she became possessed with an eager desire to get to the top of it. A mighty effort of will carried her there, and there she saw the great master of the White Lodge, to whom she properly belonged, and flew, so to speak, to his arms. Her restoration to the long forfeited place in the occult world was accomplished. From that time on she has been a much beloved member of the great master's variegated household, an industrious worker, as she descends from that happy condition at will to the lower levels of the astral plane, where she carries such help and consolation as may be permissible to those who are, in one way or another, going through the painful consequences of such lives as that she last led. Viewed in a comprehensive survey, the whole story is highly instructive as well as touching. It may warn us not to jump to hasty conclusions in contemplating any one life. Few of us, had we chanced to meet M. during the last deplorable life she went through, would have been otherwise than shocked at the idea that, 71, she was on the brink of becoming much more than a merely happy denizen or a high level in the next world, actually an intimate assistant, on the staff, so to speak, of the White Lodge. Appearances from the worldly point of view are apparent to be misleading, and this thought brings to my mind a story I heard many years ago in connection with the records of ordinary spiritualism. There was a certain young girl in a very comfortably circumstanced family, who was beloved and admired in every way by her belongings and regarded as quite of an angelic nature. She died young, and her friends assumed as a matter of course that she must have passed at once to the seventh heaven, whatever that may be, welcomed by celestial hosts of the most exalted order. Many years elapsed before her mourning friends heard of her. Then at last she did communicate through a psychic acquaintance, and explained that she had been having a very bad time indeed, though at last it was getting better. I have no information of my own on the subject, but we may assume that the life, abruptly ended in youth, was one of a series not by any means angelic in all cases, or again, that the curious and subtle operation of the karmic law reserved for the astral, 72, conclusion of the life the development of characteristics which the short physical life had not brought into manifestation. Anyhow, if the facts were as I was told, the little story is again instructive as a pendant to the much more thrilling one I have been engaged in discussing. 73, a happy passing. As the information required for my present purpose gradually accumulated on my hands, I became impressed with a feeling to the effect that my stories were rather too much colored by the record of distressful conditions immediately following physical decease. It was important beyond question to understand these, and to realize what characteristics in life gave rise to distressful conditions, but at the same time I knew quite well that large numbers of people whose lives had been fairly meritorious passed swiftly and undisturbed through the lower levels of the astral plane and only awoke to consciousness on the fourth sublevel. It occurred to me that one important type of humanity had not been represented by any of the next life narratives collected so far. I wanted a case in which highly advanced intelligence should have been united with a fairly clean physical plane record. And, knowing, 74, that most of the great scientific men of the past were still making use of the opportunities afforded by the high levels of the astral plane, I asked if any one of them would be good enough to give me a detailed account of his early experiences on passing over. The response came from one who undeniably belonged to the category I indicated, and whose passing was of comparatively recent date. I need not be too explicit in dealing with this interesting experience. Enough to say that though highly distinguished in the ordinary world of science, A.R. was also a student, to a certain extent, of the higher occultism, and deeply concerned during life with spiritualistic research. So he had no surprises to encounter on getting free of the body at a very advanced stage. He floated for a little while over his deathbed, enjoying a feeling of renewed vigor, peace, and joy. He fully understood the situation, and looked with some interest at the body he had quitted, and with sympathy at the friends around who were mourning his departure. Then he had a feeling of going up, and one which he found it difficult to describe, a feeling, as he put it, of being drawn into himself. He lost consciousness for a time. He has since learned, 75, that it was for about 3 days of our time. He awoke on some high level of the fourth, lying on what seemed a bank of some soft material in the midst of a lovely scene, flowers all around and a beautiful view with mountains in the distance, and a general sense of warmth, light, and color. He realized that his astral body now bore the appearance it had in life some 40 years previously. He lay for a time in a very pleasant reverie. Then he got up feeling quite light. There was no gravitational stress to deal with. He saw some people he knew, and then, suddenly, his surroundings changed. He found himself in a room where he was received by a crowd of his former friends of the scientific world. As I have said already, he passed on at a very advanced stage, so that most of those whom he had known in life were already in the next state of existence. They had gathered together to welcome him, and he had a delightful talk with them. He was now generally on the fifth subplane, but this and the higher fourth are very closely associated. Indeed, I have learned that men of science passing over, always assuming that they either have no disagreeables to get over in the first instance, or have got through these 76, spend a great deal of their time on the fourth, even after they are entirely free of the fifth. On the fifth they carry on their work and study in whatever department of research their bent leads them into, and descend into the fourth for what may be described as social intercourse with their friends. A.R. recognizes to the full how greatly he benefited, when coming into his inheritance in the next world, from his investigation during physical life of superphysical mysteries. Spiritualistic experience and belief, even of the ordinary type, is enormously better an introduction to the next world than blank ignorance of the agnostic order, or even than the shadowy suggestions of commonplace ecclesiastical teaching. This idea will be very clearly illustrated by the next story I have to tell, where the consequences of positive disbelief in any future are made apparent. 77x.y.s Enlightenment, the narrative which, as I have just said, illustrates the effect of going on with positive disbelief in any future life, was obtained for me in response to my desire to get touch with someone who had gone on in something like that attitude of mind, but without being hampered by any definitely evil characteristics. My friend, of the Master's entourage, who has been especially helpful to me in this series of investigations, brought along, of course with his own cordial consent, a man who in life, protracted to advanced stage, had been conspicuous rather for his cynical worldly wit, coupled with brilliant intellectual gifts, than for interest in any variety of philosophical or religious thought. In fact, to put the matter more plainly, he was all but an atheist, disbelieving, I think, in any survival of the soul after death, invariably pouring ridicule on occult research of any sort, but nonetheless a kindly natured man in all the 78 ordinary relations of life. When I realized who it was I was speaking to, I was intensely interested in the prospect of hearing how he had encountered his unexpected resumption of consciousness out of the body. He had been perfectly fearless in the physical body as the end approached. Fearlessness, indeed, had been one of the characteristics of the man all through life. But he was immensely puzzled when, after a change only associated with a sound as of something that went click, he found himself looking at his body as something external to himself. He saw some relatives gathered round apparently showing distress, but he could not succeed in attracting their attention, in making them hear the assurance he wanted to give, that he was still there. This failure made him furious. He felt better than he felt for years, wanted desperately to say so, but the effort was quite in vain. Then he found himself floating up and fell into a doze. Naturally, he does not know how long this lasted, but he woke up lying on a couch in a room, and sitting beside him he suddenly recognized an old friend who had been closely associated with him in some of his public work during life, but who had passed away many, 79, years previously. "Here you are, my boy," the friend said in the most natural way. "Come, get up." And then he was up without any sort of effort. "What's the matter?" he asked. "Why, you're dead," said the other. "What rot," he declared. "I was never more alive." His utter incredulity lasted for some time. Disbelief was so ingrained in the character of the man that the new experiences around him, so incompatible with physical life, merely left him dazed and bewildered. He was out in the open country in a little while and met another well-known friend who had been intimate with him down here. Then several others, but the muddled frame of mind was excessively distasteful to him. He had always been in the habit of thinking so clearly, of having all his ideas cut and dried. The country scene was pleasant, undulating country, something like the Sussex Downs, but after a while he was back again in his bungalow cottage, as he called it, feeling a little less muddled. And, sitting there thinking, he became aware that there was someone else in the room who addressed him by his name. This was an Eastern-looking man, looked like an Egyptian. "X. Y," asked him who he was, and a name was given that did not, 80, illuminate the situation. "Who are you?" "I am one of the workers under so-and-so," mentioning another name. "And now I'm just as wise as I was before," replied X. V. The conversation went on, and the Egyptian said he would show him what his condition would have been, as a consequence of his disbelieving attitude of mind in life, if he had not been helped. The help had been given him by reason of claims deep down in his nature, of which he knew nothing. Then X. Y. says he had the feeling of drifting downhill a long way, and of getting into a region of cold white fog. It was very comfortless and miserable. He could hear a sound of jabbering voices, but could not see anybody. And his Egyptian guide had disappeared. "It got on my nerves," he said to me. At the time he called out to the Egyptian by the name that had been given to him, and immediately the Egyptian was back again. X. V. frankly begged to be taken back, away from there. The Egyptian explained that his intensely negative attitude of mind in life had created an aura around him that would have kept him in that region for a long time if he had not been helped as above referred to. This jarred upon one line of thought that had been habitual, 81, with him. He did not want any vicarious atonement. He would rather bear his own burdens. But the objection was cleared away. He was entitled to the help, though he did not understand it. Then he got back to his bungalow, and declared that he wanted something to do. He had been an active man all his life, and he did not want merely to laze away the time in dreamy enjoyment. The Egyptian told him that if he really wished for some sphere of activity, the thought would give it him. With his long habit of skepticism, he made an attempt to desire opportunities for activity, but was aware all the time that at the back of his mind there was a certain sense of enjoying laziness. The result was curious. The conditions of the room seemed to get confused. Things that had before seemed real, became half broken up. Eventually, however, the desire for activity became more clearly formed, and then suddenly the scene changed. X. Y. found himself in a large room among a crowd of old journalistic friends, who welcomed him, and soon he found himself once more becoming interested in politics. Since then he has been more and more absorbed in watching the course of events in Parliament and in attempting to, 82, influence men there along the lines of his own sympathies, which are so far but little changed from what they were in life down here. For he is very slow to change in any way, skeptical still about any information he gets concerning conditions of existence beyond those he has already come into touch with. He has, indeed, modified one view he formerly held. An ardent partisan while himself a member of the House of Commons, he sees now that the party system is bad, but I should be anticipating what I suspect may ultimately be the drift of his opinions if I venture to indicate any definite changes, along the lines of the distrust of the party system, as likely to command his future acceptance. 83. The Troubles of S. O.